Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, Mitt Romney has a second meeting with Donald Trump. Jason Chaffetz balks at calls for an investigation of the president-elect. Utah lawyers launch an organization to come to the aid of refugees and immigrants who are discriminated against. A push for more education spending and, potentially related, a dearth of Utah liquor stores. And joining me for this discussion, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Arts and culture reporter Kathy Stevenson. Hello, and welcome for being welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Education reporter Benjamin Wood. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning. Good to be here.
And government and politics reporter Lee Davidson. Thanks for being here as well, Lee.
Thank you.
And listeners, you are invited to join this discussion with your questions and comments. Call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also comment at sltrib.com. One thing I actually didn't tease right there, but that I think is an interesting way to kick things off this hour. Lee Davidson, you reported this week that as part of a multi-state, I guess, victory tour in advance of his inauguration, Donald Trump is coming to Utah. How did you find that out, and when is he coming here?
Well, we don't know exactly when he's coming. The Trump campaign announced that he's doing a thank you tour to the 30 states that he won, to thank them for their support.
And he's shunning the states that he didn't win, I take it.
Sounds like it.
Okay.
You know, he'll be president of everyone, but he just really wants to say thank you to those that helped him over the top.
Okay.
James Evans, the chairman of the Utah Republican Party, said that the campaign has been working with him and is planning events, but he said he'll leave the announcements to exactly when they'll come and what they'll do to the Trump campaign when they're ready to do it.
Okay.
The thank you tour kicked off yesterday in Ohio, and actually Mr. Trump mentioned Utah there. He was kind of saying, reminding people that they thought Utah would go to some guy he had never heard of. Maybe he couldn't remember Evan McMullen's name, but he said, but Utahns were amazing in his word and came out and supported him. Of course, he won the state with a plurality, 45.5%, which means more people in Utah actually voted against him than for him. But he won. It's winner take all to whoever wins the plurality.
And that he did. You know, I covered back in March the protests that happened that coincided with the Trump rally here in Salt Lake City. And this was before he became the GOP nominee. I'm wondering, I'm imagining it's kind of a given that when he comes for his victory tour, there will be some level of have we heard anything about that, protests?
Haven't heard, but there's always protests. Whenever a president or someone of power comes, there's always almost always a protest.
Somebody protesting, right.
And, of course, you mentioned the primaries out here. Trump finished third in the caucus voting. So he may not want to thank us for that, but he'll thank the state for the
electoral votes that they gave him. Well, as Trump's inauguration approaches, we're getting more cabinet appointments. This week we learned that hedge fund manager and Hollywood producer Steven Mnuchin was Trump's choice for Treasury Secretary. Yesterday, Trump told that same rally that he'd appoint General James Mattis as Secretary of Defense. No announcement yet on his pick to lead the State Department, but this week Mitt Romney had his second meeting with Trump amid speculation that he could be tapped for Secretary of State. And Dan Harry, Salt Lake Tribune government editor, tell us about this second meeting between Trump and Romney.
Well, the most remarkable thing about it was the pictures. And if you haven't seen the pictures of Donald Trump, Mitt Romney, and Reince Priebus at the table in the, I think it was a 3-star Michelin restaurant, you've got to go find them because they are amazing. In one photo, one of the still photos, Donald Trump has this look on his face as though you had just gotten revenge on a bully who'd been beating you up in the schoolyard. And Mitt Romney looked, I don't know, like he wasn't quite sure what he was supposed to be doing there. So he had nice words afterward for the president-elect. He said that he believes his message of unification that Trump gave in the election night speech, very late on election night, and that he wants, as Lee had said, to be the president of all Americans. And so he said he thinks that Donald Trump could lead the country to do some good new things. This was a remarkable turnabout from what Mitt Romney had said throughout the campaign, which was that Trump was a phony, a fraud. He was a danger to the country. And it was, like I said, a remarkable turnaround.
Well, and because of because of that turnaround, that sort of change of tune, or at least his willingness to meet with Trump, I've seen a fair amount of criticism on Twitter, elsewhere, of this meeting of Romney in particular for meeting with Trump. What does this meeting say about Romney or about Trump? Who had actually taken offense, of course, at some of the things that Romney had said during in his previous statements. Is this him auditioning for Secretary of State? Do we know that, or is it just a?
That's what it seems like. There's two ways to look at it, and I think Chris Salisa from the Washington Post had a good take on it, which is, one, you can look at this as a true patriot who had criticisms of his party's nominee during the campaign and voiced those. He felt an obligation to do so. And now that the election's over, he is trying to do his part to say, look, this is the going to be the president. We've all got to get behind him. We all want him to succeed. So that's one way of looking at it. The other is that the old stereotype, Mitt Romney will say anything, do anything to advance his own ambitions.
Well, it could be said of so many politicians, right?
Yeah, and that's the problem. I think that's one of the reasons that Donald Trump caught on with a large part of the electorate was he didn't seem to be the old stereotype politician, that's for sure.
A quick reminder to listeners, and in fact, listeners, we invite you to give us your take on this meeting. You can join the conversation with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. There are some other names being floated for Secretary of State, among them Rudy Giuliani, David Petraeus. Yesterday, we heard that ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson was being considered. There's been some public infighting in the Trump campaign over Romney, which, of course, could just be theater. But Dan, Romney offered some praise of Trump this week. Do we assume that that's a position that he wants? He wants Secretary of State. That's the same question again in a different way, I guess.
Yeah, I think he probably would accept that if he was offered that position. It's hard for me to see that happening. You know, the Secretary of State is a position where a president wants someone who very much shares their worldview, and It's a person that goes out to every nation in the world and represents sort of what the president is thinking. And where Mitt Romney and Donald Trump have been, it's real hard to see how those two would have that kind of a relationship where, Trump could trust Romney to deliver his message. But who knows? In this coming administration, stranger things have happened.
Well, as long as we're on the topic of appointments, another Utahn thought to be in the running for a job in the new administration, or who has been thought to be in the running, was Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes. In fact, his name for a time was being mentioned as a potential transportation secretary. That didn't happen, though, right, Dan?
That didn't happen. That's right. And so Hughes was back in Washington when Chao was named the transportation secretary, the wife, by the way, of Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader. So, and Hughes said the talks with the transition team then turned into kind of picking his brain for advice on transit issues and transportation issues.
You know, I mentioned the Trump rally the visit by Trump back in March. Hughes actually introduced Trump at that time and has been a stalwart supporter. So is he still in the running for something? Might he go to D.C.? Do we know?
I don't have any insights into that. I do know that he has said he didn't want to be working in the bowels of some federal bureaucracy pushing papers. So that's a signal that, he would take a position in the administration if offered, but it would have to be something significant and of some high status.
That's Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. And before we close out with the appointments or jockeying for positions in the Trump administration, Representative Mike Noel is putting his name in the hat to be head of the Bureau of Land Management, correct?
That is correct. And there are also whispers of Don Pay in some position over public lands, perhaps even Interior Secretary. I kind of will wait to see if those things happen. People love to speculate, and we always have the name game, and that's what's going on here. Mike Noel would really be interesting because he is a former BLM employee and now has long retired from there, and is the agency's biggest critic.
Right.
He relentlessly attacks the BLM and the federal government and their policies on public lands. And so if we did see that happen, you would see a huge change in the way that agency is operated.
A very different BLM. From what I understand, Noel had essentially submitted a resume, a kind of filed. Like, he hadn't been contacted. He was reaching out to the Trump campaign to say,
I would imagine he was invited to go ahead and do that. He was, he has a good friendship with Don Pay and others who have very strong connections with the Trump people.
Okay. Well, there's still more to cover in the realm of politics here on the program. When we come back from a short break, we'll turn to Representative Jason Chaffetz and what he might or might not be planning as head of the House Oversight Committee. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and around the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. You're listening to it here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. It's the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Tribune's Dan Harry, Benjamin Wood, Kathy Stevenson, and Lee Davidson. You can join the conversation by commenting at sltrib.com. There's a Behind the Headlines page currently live there. Or you can call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, sticking with you for just a moment longer. The Tribune reported this week that Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz, who is head of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, got a letter from Democrats on that committee demanding that he look into Donald Trump's multinational business relationships, his financial entanglements that could represent a conflict of interest. Yesterday, Chaffetz kind of responded to that request. What did he have to say?
Well, his initial response was no comment, which, if you know Jason Chaffetz, is very unusual. He is the most loquacious by far of our congressional members. He hands his cell phone number out to reporters, and, that's a good thing. I mean, access, but he's also known to, like the microphone. And he had no comment when that letter first came out. So the second time around, all Democratic members of the committee signed the letter asking for these investigations. And his response yesterday finally was, we need to give the president-elect a break. We're not going to do any kind of investigation, at least until he's sworn into office. And then if there's a legitimate allegation, we will investigate those. Basically in due time. So, there's no promises here really to investigate anything in the Trump administration. But I think in his heart of hearts, Representative Chaffetz really wants to keep investigating Hillary Clinton.
Right.
But the folks above, I think, have sent a very clear signal that is not going to happen.
Trump himself has said that that he doesn't want to pursue investigations into Clinton.
Yeah, and I get the impression that congressional leaders are on board with that. The election's over. Hillary Clinton may become a political figure of the past as far as electoral politics goes. So let's move on and do something new. But I think that's a hard one for Representative Chaffetz to give up.
Sure. Just getting back to Donald Trump's business interests and whether or not they could be investigated. This week, Trump, in a lengthy press release, I'm kidding, in a series of tweets, said he was going to disentangle himself from his financial empire. He didn't specify how he would do that. He said that announcement would come later this month. But will that have an impact on Chaffetz's appetite or calculus on potentially looking into the new administration?
Well, it sounds like not. I mean, he's said that, you know, his committee is not going to investigate or do anything to look into these potential conflicts, at least until after the inauguration. So that part of where the committee is going is clear. You know, and as you said, we don't really know what Donald Trump is going to do to separate himself from his businesses. When you're announcing your policy and your practices in tweets, you know, the details are lacking. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons he likes to get these messages out by tweet.
Well, spur speculation and, of course, news coverage,
yeah,
which is something that he's been very good at. A quick reminder to our listeners that we want to hear your thoughts on the stories that we're covering today. You can call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or comment at sltrib.com. A lot to be determined, I guess, still on that. Maybe after the inauguration, we'll hear more. Lee Davidson, I want to get back to some stories that you have covered this week. After the election of Donald Trump, the Southern Poverty Law Center was tracking reports of harassment and intimidation against immigrants, Muslims, African Americans, members of the LGBT community. This week, you reported on the formation of a legal group here in Utah to defend people who suffer certain kinds of discrimination. Tell us about this new group.
Well, it's called the Refugee Justice League, which sounds like they're superheroes or something, but it's actually a group of lawyers. As they announced their formation, there were at least 50 of them. However, they say that they have more lawyers every day calling to ask to join. They promised to help especially Muslim refugees without cost whenever they face discrimination or problems. And they say they did it because of reports of increased bullying, harassment, threatening young Muslim girls to have their religious headdresses pulled off, that sort of thing. Hmm. They seem to have a lot of positive reaction to that. They had a Muslim community leader with them named Noor Ul Hassan. She got a lot of press the day after the election, saying that she thought that Mormons had abandoned her and other Muslims, thinking that they would stand up against Mr. Trump. And she said she's changed her mind with the formation of this league and some statements this week by the governor saying that he's also supporting refugees, and also our attorney general saying he did not like the idea of a Muslim registry or internment camps like the Japanese in World War II, that now she says she thinks Utahans have the Muslims back,
you know,
refugees.
You in this article, you mentioned that this group has even threatened to take the president to court, I guess, if the talk of creating that registry of Muslims becomes a reality. And they would probably have a strong constitutional ground for doing that. I mean, that's speculation on my part, but
it would be on mine too. Yeah. I'm not a legal expert, but they have vowed that if he did that, yes, they would sue, and they think that there would be lawsuits in every state also. And one of the things they're doing is trying to encourage lawyers in other states to set up similar leagues to help protect refugees.
Okay, to set up similar. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the Refugee Justice League. It does sound like a superhero group. The founding lawyers involved in this effort talk about Utah being a place that is supportive of refugees because of its own history, its own makeup of largely Mormon population.
Right. They point out that Utah was founded by Mormon pioneers who came here to escape religious persecution and to pursue religious freedom. And they say modern refugees are doing the same thing. And so they think most Utahns support refugees and don't like talk of a Muslim registry or harassment of the group. So they think there's a lot of support in the state for them.
Well, it's a really interesting initiative, though that there's a need for it seems to say a lot about the state of things right now. I'm wondering, do we know of any sort of pending cases that they're working on, anything like that yet?
No. And they also say that they want to take kind of a light approach to this. They don't want to immediately jump into court. They think that would only raise the temperature of things. They say they would rather meet with people or make a phone call or write a letter and sue as kind of a last resort. They're also planning a lot of educational efforts to teach refugees what their legal rights are here. They point out that many of them come from oppressive governments where people who raise a fuss, get in trouble. And they want to teach them that, no, in America, you can complain and not be thrown in jail.
You have rights that, that you can rely on. All right. Well, check out that reporting at sltrib.com. Lots of great stuff from Lee Davidson there. And I actually want to go back to the realm of politics for a moment and kind of close out the overtly political section of the program. Political aspirations that are maybe not yet congealed, but coming together of former Utah Governor John Huntsman Jr. Dan Harry, the former governor, he's the former ambassador to China, is maybe considering a run for Senator Orrin Hatch's Senate seat. Is that
That's
right?
That's what he said, which means he's probably going to run. He's also, among those many other things, the brother of the Tribune owner and publisher. So
I was going to nudge you for a disclaimer.
We're all on the political desk squirming a little bit over the prospects of that. But we'll deal with it as it comes.
Is Huntsman Jr.'s run contingent on whether Hatch runs for an eighth term?
You know, it doesn't sound like it. Former Governor Huntsman gave a very interesting statement the other day. He praised Hatch, but he also reminded anyone who was listening to him that he, as he put it, I believe, the senator has served the state of Utah in a wonderful way, and he's done so for almost a half a century. So it's kind of a constant reminder of how long Senator Hatch has been in office, and it is a remarkable long period of time to be in office.
Okay, so a tongue-in-cheek reminder from the former governor. Hatch himself has been urged, apparently, by some, or he says that he's been urged by a number of people to run again.
Right. I'm sure in Senator Hatch's ears it sounds like a clamor for him to run for re-election again. And, there are prominent folks that have worked with Senator Hatch for many, many years, and they like his style. They think they can work with him, and so they do want to see him run again. But there's a lot of folks out there too who are not quite as vocal because you don't want to stick your head up too soon in this battle. But there are a lot of folks out there who share the feeling that the seven terms that the senator will have completed in 2018 is enough, and it's now time for some new blood.
I feel like it's almost obligatory to point out the fact that Hatch, when he ran initially, whenever we're having this conversation, ran on a term limits platform.
Right. He ran against Ted Moss, who was a three-term senator, and his slogan was, what do you call a three-term senator? You call him home. Mm-hmm. Well, and here we are in the seventh term. But again, Senator Hatch is a formidable campaigner, and I don't think anybody should underestimate if he's got his mindset, and it seems that he does. He's going to be a formidable opponent to anybody.
Dan, just historically, I'm thinking that 2018 is rapidly approaching. When might we learn of announcements from people? Is it early in the year?
You got to remember we just had an election, I feel kind of bad about readers and anybody else that
we're sorry.
We're not even quite done with this one. In fact, there's a couple of races in Utah where we're still undergoing recounts.
Right.
And now we're talking about the 2018 election. It's just like, can we not have a break? Yes, that's the political editor saying that.
All right.
But,
we're
not going to have a break. There's tons of political news coming out of Washington every day.
I skipped a year anyways. We're heading into 2017 very shortly. We'll wait. We'll wait. I'll ask you that question in a year, Dan, see how we do. Let's move away from these overtly political topics and on to education funding and alcohol, which obviously have a political aspect to them as well. And I'm going to begin with Kathy Stevenson. Kathy, we've been talking about election year politics. The election surely drove some people to drink. That's the segue I'm going with for a story that you covered this week. The DABC released a report showing that there is a need for more liquor stores in the state of Utah. What did this report say?
Basically, we, like you said, we need more liquor stores. Our population is growing, and our per capita consumption is increasing. So those two things combined make our Utah liquor stores crowded. Sometimes you can't find a place to park. The shelves are empty. The DABC has gone on record. They want to build liquor stores. They have to go to the legislature, though, to build those. They have to go to the building board first, and then they must get approval from the legislature. They get revenue bonds, which I think a lot of government entities don't get that because they can use revenue, but they have to get approval from the legislature first.
Is there's a formula, right, under Utah code that determines how many liquor stores are allowed in the state,
yes,
right?
Yes, so you get one store for every 48,000 people. So currently there's 44, but we have 3 million people in the state, so we technically could have 63 stores. So there is room in the law currently to have 19 more. Money, the legislature has, or the DABC has said they've had a hard time placing liquor stores in some communities. They go to them and say, hey, we want to put one in your community, and the city balks. So this was part of the reason they did this survey, because there was a survey done by the University of Utah School of Business about 3 years ago that just looked at cities that need it. This survey kind of expanded that and looked at regions and kind of metro areas. So say Riverton was on the top of the list needing a liquor store. That was the number one need. But if Riverton doesn't want it, they could kind of put it in just that South Valley area. So the DABC would have a little more flexibility to go to Harriman or Bluffdale or some other communities that might be more willing to do that. I thought one of the interesting parts of this study, it was done by the Zions Financial Group, part of Zions Bank. They looked at, the benefits of putting a liquor store in your city. You get tax dollars, and the county gets tax dollars. So cities who kind of say no are giving up some sales tax money.
Right. Well, before a city can say no, obviously the legislature has to act on the recommendations that have been provided. They have to fund the construction of these and approve that. Is that something that we're going to see in this next legislative session as a result of this report?
Maybe. They've been trying to do one a year. So there is one in West Valley currently being constructed. Should be done, I think, in the spring. They've approved one in Syracuse. And then I'm sure they will go back to the building board. I'm sure Lee will cover the building board, or somebody will. And, they'll pitch their next one. And it sounds like South Valley. The top five are all in the suburbs. Salt Lake City has, I think, plenty for their population. But the suburbs, Riverton, Layton, Pleasant Grove, Sandy, and Taylorsville are the top five metro areas that need another liquor store. So,
okay.
And as our population increases, that means we're going to need more of them too. So,
I just have to ask: does this mean that there are a greater number of imbibing people in Sandy in these particular areas?
I think it's just our changing demographics, right? I live in Bountiful, and I've told people for years, if you go to the Bountiful liquor store at 10 to 7 before it closes, there's a long line. You can't find a parking spot because it's the only liquor store between, Bountiful and Layton and Salt Lake. So it's encompassing a large group of people, and we're growing, and we're diversifying. And so that's what's happening in Utah.
Well, Kathy Stevenson, I want to come back to you after we take a short break and stay with a related story on alcohol and Lamb's Cafe in downtown Salt Lake City. Lamb's Grill, I should say. It's time for a quick break right now. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Kathy Stevenson, Lee Davidson, Dan Harry, and Benjamin Wood. Join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. And Kathy, before we went to the break, we were talking about the need for new liquor stores. Also on the sort of DABC, topic. You reported that Lamb's Cafe, one of the oldest restaurants in Utah, Lamb's Grill, is losing money because it had its liquor license taken away. It also had a fine levied against it by the DABC. What's happening to this Main Street icon?
It's sad. This is one of Utah's oldest restaurants, and they have been serving liquor. But one of the rules when you have a liquor license, when you change ownership, if 50% of the ownership changes, you must notify the DABC. Ownership changed at Lamb's, and nobody told the DABC. When the DABC found out, they said, you got to stop selling liquor. Your license is no longer valid. And that was in October. It's considered a grave violation to do that. And so they came before the Liquor Commission on Tuesday, and they were fined $9,000, which is the minimum fine in those situations. So they got the minimum fine, but they were already struggling because if you go without a liquor license for 2 months in downtown Salt Lake City, the owner said he'd lost at least $40,000, $12,000 in October, $13,000 in November. And then parties who had said, hey, we want to bring our business in here and have a party, when they found out they couldn't have liquor, canceled. So it was a huge blow.
This was the new owners of the restaurant just not filing the right paperwork.
Not filing the right paperwork. I think some of our commenters on this story said, you know, it happened before. It happened at the airport. Somebody bought a restaurant, didn't let the DABC know. And so, you know, is the DABC letting businesses know, hey, you know, this is something in the requirement? You know, it's in there. You should read it. You should never question the DABC, I guess. But I'm not sure business owners know the law. It's confusing. So
a manual could be helpful or something.
Yes.
I understand that Lambs now has been approved for a new license, but because of the change of ownership, they are no longer grandfathered in and will have to have a so-called Zion curtain built.
They have to, yes. So once they lost the license and then they have to reapply, then they're considered a new restaurant. And any new restaurant since 2009 falls under the Zion curtain law. You have to have the 7-foot barrier so that customers can't see you mixing and pouring drinks. So they've been trying to figure out how to do that. There is a back room at Lambs, so they're kind of cordoning it off and trying to get that. So the owner has to pay the $9,000 fine, and the DABC has to approve that Zion curtain. They're kind of waiting on both. I talked to the manager yesterday, and he says, no, it's not. They thought maybe it'd be by the end of the week, like today, and he says, I don't think so. The laws are confusing.
The construction of the Zion's curtain was a requirement after the change of ownership or after the loss of the license and then reapplying and getting it?
Well, the loss of the license, because then they got categorized as a new restaurant. Anybody that was serving alcohol and had a liquor license before 2009 was just grandfathered in, and they didn't have to build that. It's just any new restaurant since then. And so then Lambs is considered a new restaurant applying,
okay,
even though they've had one for years.
I want to remind listeners that you can call us with your thoughts, 801-355-TALK or at sltrib.com. A lot of history to Lambs Cafe, a lot of interesting deals made at its booths and tables over the years, over the many decades. Kathy Stevenson, is Lambs in any greater risk of going away? Will it live on?
I hope so. Maybe this is a little rallying cry. Maybe some businesses will book parties or, you know, help them out. I hope it survives.
Okay.
I mean, I hope lots of people in downtown, especially because they were banking on the Eccles Center that just opened. They kind of survived all that construction, and now the theater's open, and I think they were hoping, hey, people could come and have dinner before a show and have a drink, and so I think they could make it. If they can do all the what's required.
Okay, well, there's some great reporting that you can find at sltrib.com from Kathy Stevenson. I'm going to turn now to a patient, Benjamin Wood, Salt Lake Tribune education reporter. Thanks for waiting for the hour.
Of course.
A couple of stories that you reported on this week related to funding for education in Utah. First off, some Utah business leaders say that the time has come for Utah to put more money into public education, but they're not going to lawmakers for this. They are going to the public. What's their plan?
They are launching a ballot initiative. And for some context, I mean, it's been a conversation that's been around for a few years. They have, in fact, gone to legislators before. Last year, this same group wanted to put a non-binding question of a tax increase on the ballot. Lawmakers didn't appear to have much interest there. So now they're going around the legislature, straight to the voters, and they're going to start collecting signatures this summer for a 2018 ballot.
And so last year's the non-binding initiative would have said, you know, hypothetically, I mean, what is the nine?
Yeah, it would have been like a poll, but run through the ballot instead of a polling firm. So the idea was that it would have signaled to the lawmakers that they were clear or approved from the voters to go ahead and raise taxes, because tax increases are seen as somewhat toxic politically for most of our legislators.
Okay, going around the legislature to get this increase in funding is a way to do that. What's the process for them to make that happen?
Yeah, so the process, would be what we saw recently with Count My Vote. It's something like 100,000 signatures from most of the Senate districts in the state. It's not an easy task, but this is a group with considerable influence. It's, you know, it's familiar faces like Gail Miller of the Larry H. Miller Group, Lane Beatty from the Salt Lake Chamber, Nolan Karras, former House Speaker. So it's certainly a group of people who have the resources in the organization to get this done. It's probably just a matter of time.
Okay, ballot initiative for a tax income tax increase, I guess is the way to put it. Do we know how much that increase would be? How much are they looking for?
So right now the income tax rate is 5%. They're looking to raise it to 5.875. Their pitch is that it's 0.7%, so get ready to hear that a lot for the next 2 years. And that would raise about $750 million, and they have a plan to distribute that to both K-12 and higher ed based on per student. So each Utah student would get about $900, would follow them to wherever they're at.
Okay, so obviously this group of business leaders, Education First, is behind this. They're, you know, they're putting the momentum forward. Who else wants to see this happen? Teachers, I imagine, but who is opposed to it?
Yeah, the UEA is supportive. Members of the PTA are on the steering committee. I mean, it's kind of the people you would expect to be in favor. As far as opposition, that's a little trickier. The Sutherland Institute recently put out an op-ed and an essay about how a tax increase isn't needed. Obviously, there's going to be conservative tax watchdog groups. I would expect the Utah Taxpayers Association to chime in at some point. But yeah, as far as the opposition, that might be forthcoming.
Okay. Well, this ties in closely to another story you wrote. In fact, it seems hot on the heels of another story you wrote, a report from the Utah Foundation saying that state tax policy has cost Utah public schools a lot of money over the years. How much money are we talking about?
Well, to use their figures, they put it at about $1.2 billion, and that's over 20 years, and that's saying the funding that we're at right now versus the funding we could be at is a difference of $1.2 billion. So not that we've lost $1.2 billion, but right, that we could have gained that much more.
What sort of policies led to that, I guess, gap?
Right. I mean, the big one they point to is 2007, the tax cut in the income tax, which happened on the eve of the Great Recession. And since then, there's been kind of a growing chorus of people saying that the timing probably wasn't the best. That cost a lot of money, the income tax, as well as things like Truth in Taxation, which before that, you could passively capture inflation growth. Now, the tax rate adjusts downward to remain revenue neutral.
Right.
And also, I'm blanking on some of the other ones.
Constitutional amendment, yes, that allowed the sharing of income tax with higher education.
That's right. So until the mid-90s, all of the income tax was reserved for K-12. But with that, a constitutional amendment, it's now split between higher ed and K-12.
Okay. Well, that report sounds like it would be fodder for Education First, who's trying to run this ballot initiative. Are they using that specifically as something to point to?
Oh, absolutely. That report came out on Monday. By no coincidence, the ballot initiative was announced the next day using all of the facts and figures from that report. So there's definitely a timing element to the release of those numbers.
Is there when do they want to have it on the ballot?
They're hoping to have it on the 2018 ballot, and so they'll have roughly a year to gather signatures and get everything certified with the elections office. They'll begin that process this summer for then November of 2 years out.
Okay. Ben Wood, education reporter. Find his reporting at sltrib.com. Before we go to our underplayed stories of the week, I want to ask Lee Davidson about something that he covered, which was that Utah drivers are apparently really bad drivers. Lee, tell us about that.
Well, probably doesn't surprise anyone who drives the freeways here. But yesterday, a study came out, and Quote Wizard, which is a group that helps people search for low insurance rates, said they looked at 2 million data points about such things as accidents, speeding, traffic tickets, drunken driving, and they had a dark conclusion about our state. They said, quote, Utah drivers are the worst in the nation. And, it doesn't surprise me. On my way to work this morning, I counted how many times someone tried to kill me. It was only 4 this morning. And, at a red light, I saw, four cars, run the red light. A variety of studies through the years give us either bad or really good rates, rankings. We tend to rank well when they look just at fatalities. As this new study said, on the bright side, Utah missed our list of worst states for fatalities, so at least fewer people are dying in all those accidents. Allstate kind of earlier this year gave us mediocre ratings based on accidents that it's people at insurers in Utah reported. But anyway, we have a long way to go to improve.
I'm realizing that it's late in the program to open up the phone lines right now for people to gripe about drivers in the state of Utah. But get us next week. We can take your comments then, maybe. Guys, I think we should turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. This is stories that maybe didn't get a lot of press and require coverage, or something interesting that we didn't touch on today. Who's ready with an underplayed story of the week? Dan Harry.
Okay, I'm going to go with the I mentioned there are still recounts going on, and the most high profile is in a House district where LeVar Christensen beat his challenger, Democrat Suzanne Harris, is it?
Harrison.
Harrison, mm-hmm. by 3 votes. Hmm. So that's well within the recount zone, so that will be recounted. I think the results are supposed to be announced next week on that. I don't recall ever seeing a recount change a result in election, but 3 votes, you never know. It could happen.
Right. And a lot of these ballots were mail-in ballots. Is that correct?
Yeah, a lot of them are mail-in ballots. And, you know, LeVar Christensen, very well-known conservative on Capitol Hill. He was the sponsor of the ban on same-sex marriage, which, of course, has been overturned by the courts now. But that's one of his big issues is religious liberty now is his the drumbeat that he's beating now. So,
Well, all right. So vote recount from Dan Harry for his underplayed story of the week. Benjamin, what have you got one?
Yeah, I don't know about underplayed, but interesting. Our colleague Alex Stuckey had a report this week about a research project at the University of Utah that scanned the brains of practicing Mormons and essentially found that the sensation of feeling the spirit registered as in a brain scan of lighting up the regions of the brain similar to love, gambling, and drug use. And so some interesting science on faith in that story.
I want to check that out. I'm wondering if that's the same for other. Have they tested one religion against other religions to see how, you know,
according to the report, they're hoping to do that in the future. So far, it's limited to the LDS population.
All right. Ben Wood with a report at sltrip.com. Kathy Stevenson, underplayed story of the week.
Well, I'm going to pitch something from the arts and entertainment section. Our movie critic, Sean Means, has started talking about the Sundance Film Festival. I know it's about 6 weeks away, but they've started listing the new movies out,
right,
talking about virtual reality, how that's changing the New Frontier program. So keep looking online because we'll keep putting out the lists.
Are we potentially going to go to Sundance and be putting on VR headsets?
Yeah, and possibly. You know, the New Frontier is always kind of the new things coming out, and it used to be there were only a few, and now Sean's reporting that, you know, there's so many opportunities now that the Sundance had to kind of say no to some of the films, which has kind of been new. So.
All right, Kathy Stevenson with an early Sundance, plug, and Lee Davidson for your part. What underplayed story of the week have you got?
Utahns voted in record numbers this year, according to the final state canvas of voting. It said that 82% of active registered voters cast ballots. That's defined as someone who's voted in the last 8 years. That was the highest since 1964, and the highest ever by number. However, we still have a ways to go if you look at it differently. If you look at the percentage of the voting eligible population, we were down in the, high 50% range.
Is that because they haven't, voting eligible is a distinction between those who are registered and those who haven't registered.
So in short, there's a lot of people who didn't register or who didn't vote. And so we still have a long ways to go to register more people. Lieutenant Governor said some reasons it was higher this year was because of by-mail voting. Made it easier to vote, easier to research things. And also this year, Utah was sort of a swing state in the presidential election. So we had a lot more attention by high-profile presidential candidates. And so
a lot more focus and a lot more people. Of course, that didn't the turnout also had an impact on election night, as there were some long lines in certain places, if I recall correctly.
There were way long lines, up to 4 hours in some places, mainly because some county clerks thought people would simply send in their voting, their by-mail ballots, but a lot of people wanted to vote on Election Day, and they underestimated how many there would be.
Or may have been waiting to the last minute to see who they were going to vote for.
Right.
For my part, for an underplayed story of the week, I'm going to go with the ongoing theme of fake news. Yesterday morning, the Twitter account of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Science, Space, and Technology posted a link to a climate change denying article at Breitbart.com that contains a number of false assertions about our planet's changing climate. Some of the criticism I've seen on this story is that if you are the U.S. House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, why not get your data from, say, NASA instead of from Breitbart? The answer could conceivably be that this has something to do with the fact that the president-elect's chief of staff was the executive chairman of Breitbart.com. That's my underplayed story of the week. Dan Harry, Benjamin Wood, Kathy Stevenson, and Lee Davidson, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines this week.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
We will wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Today, religious believers and non-believers can get along just fine, it turns out. Just ask Kirby and his good friend, Sonny.
Sonny is probably one of the closest friends I have. And oddly enough, we're completely different in terms of spiritual belief. But it never seems to come up in our friendship. And yet you look at society and there's no shortage of people insulting each other over their religious differences. It just seems to wind people into something that their religion actually specifies that they shouldn't be.
Right, with hatred, et cetera, involved in it. The solution to this, at least for you and Sonny, has been an unintentional avoidance of the topic of religion.
I mean, yeah, we focus on stuff that's actually important to us, to our relationship. In this column I ran in the Tribune back in September, I wrote, "One of my closest friends is Sonny. We've logged thousands of miles and lots of adventures together. He's saved my life 5 times, and I've kept him from killing me 2x. Yes, we're close. We're also comfortable in our shared lunacy. We've managed to make our friendship work despite the fact that I'm a Mormon and Sonny is an avowed non-believer in anything. The difference between these two diametrically opposed life views doesn't bother us a bit because, well, I don't know. It just rarely seems to come up. We're far too busy arguing about things that actually matter to us. Which of us is a worse driver, a better shot, or, vastly more distressing, where the hell are we?"
So you have, clashing worldviews, supposedly, but not really, because you're actually out there engaged in the same stuff every day. But since you don't get too philosophical with him, you can avoid any dogfights. And you wrote about the consequences if either of you actually had the right answer.
I wrote, "If I'm right, I figure God will let Sonny into heaven anyway. He's a far better person than most religious people I know," which is true. He is. "Meanwhile, if Sonny's right, neither of us has anything at all to worry about because we'll be dead."
All right. So it's sort of a win-win or a...
It's win-win. There's no worry either way.
Also in this article, you wrote about religion and government and the role of religion in government, something that people tend to disagree on pretty regularly.
Well, yeah, this is not to say that religion should never be discussed. There are issues that come up where it plays a huge part in laws that are passed, in how society is run in a particular area.
Right.
And it has a polarizing effect. We see that here in Utah over the issue of alcohol.
Right.
In this column, right after talking about how I thought Sonny'd get into heaven anyway, I wrote, "None of this is to say that religion should never be discussed, only that it's rare that anyone's mind is ever changed by these discussions, unless it's to make them angrier or more defensive. The closest I've ever come to bringing Sonny around to my way of thinking on religion occurred during a research trip the Tribune sent me on to investigate Colorado's marijuana laws. Sonny and I were kicked back on a hillside over Glenwood Springs when part of our investigative substance suddenly hit us. The entire world calmed down and turned golden. Me, see, I told you there's a God. Him, well, if there is, he wants us to go get some potato chips." Now, see, there's a religious conversation that makes sense.
As religious a conversation as you two had probably ever had.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Robert Kirby, thank you, as always, for coming in.
You bet. Thank you.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all of his opinions, the full Kirby archives, at sltrib.com. That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams, and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. You can find us on Facebook at KCPW FM. On Twitter, we are at KCPW. A quick note that KCPW is hosting the public radio quiz show Says You next Friday, featuring local guest panelists Salt Lake Tribune editorial cartoonist Pat Bagley and State Senator Jim DeBacchus. That's at the Salt Lake City Public Library next Friday at 7 p.m. with a reception in advance of the show. You can get tickets at saysyou.net. Thanks once again for tuning in to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and on Utah Public Radio throughout the state of Utah. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us once more, and we will see you next week.